Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Please take your seats quickly, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Tennis Weekly with Joel and Kim, sponsored by DownloadTennis.com, on today's Tour Catch-Up.
Next-gen hopefuls take home Tour titles.
The WTA Final 8 is set.
And Simona Halep is provisionally suspended from competition.
Chris, today is the 25th of October and we are here, as always, to catch up on the week in tennis at Tennis Weekly HQ. We are getting to that time in the season. Finals are very nearly upon us. The ATP Finals, the Fort Worth WTA Finals, Billie Jean King Cup Finals and the Davis Cup Finals. But of course, we have some big tournaments to talk about before then. On the men's side, we've got Vienna and Basel on at the moment. And last week, we had the last W1000 tournament, Guadalajara in Mexico. Jesse Pegula, your champion, first title of the season. We also had Felix Auger-Aliassime go back-to-back titles on the ATP Tour this week with winning at the European Open against Sebi Korda. And we also had the next geners Lorenzo Musetti and Holger Rune win on the tour. So it's been a very interesting week, and interesting for you because you're actually at one of these tournaments. You were in Stockholm, I believe, for the Stockholm Open 250.
I was indeed. I was courtside for that win for Holger. I saw all the quarterfinal action as well as the finals. Didn't fancy checking the semifinals as well. Thought I'd seen enough after the quarterfinals. But I made the prediction amongst the people I was traveling with for the final and the winner. So I won a croissant out of it. So maybe that should be my highlight of the week, Joel, because there's nothing better than a free pastry.
Well, I mean, Holger Rune, I was watching some of the highlights back and Holger Rune just seemed to be on an absolute warpath.
I mean,
Patrick Mouratoglou at the moment, I know he's in the news for other reasons that we're going to get onto with regards to Simona Halep, but it also seems that he's working his magic on Holger Rune quite quickly, because that was a really, really devastating performance, wasn't it, against Tsitsipas in the final?
I was blown away.
Stefanos Tsitsipas was.
I mean, he really was. It was unbelievable. And I mean, I've seen quite a lot of live tennis. I don't think I've ever seen a 19-year-old play as complete tennis as that. And yeah, I've seen Carlos this year. So I was really, really impressed. And I can't wait to talk about it a bit later on.
Yes, we're going to be talking about that. Of course, we're going to be talking about all the finals action. But before we do, we're going to be talking about our highlights from the week. I will say before we get into this, Kim, unfortunately, has not been able to make it. She has actually been stuck. She's been marooned outside London. Travel and train issues have struck. So it does mean this episode is going to be just the Joel and Chris show, but hopefully Kim will be back next week. But Chris, without further ado, what was your one highlight of the week?
Well, I mean, I had to talk about Caroline Garcia, and I think maybe Kim's avoiding this one because after Sloane got that win against her. But I'm not talking about that match. I'm talking about a match with Rebecca Marino.
Okay.
And something that I thought was particularly interesting about this one was that Rebecca Marino hit 24 aces in that match and still lost to Caroline Garcia. It's joint fifth on the all-time list. And I started looking into this and I thought, that seems like surely not many people can lose a match having hit that many aces. And interestingly enough, of the top 16 matches with the most aces on the WTA Tour, the one who hit the highest aces has lost. So you need more than a serve on the WTA Tour to get the W. So that was my highlight of the week, was that despite having a serve that was on song, it does not mean that you're going to get through, unlike on the ATP Tour, I'd say.
I am loving this list because I'm looking at it right now and Kristina Pliskova's top of the list. 31 aces in a match and still lost to Monica Puy. And it happened the second time as well. 28 aces, which I find out that's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. They're both against, I mean, Monica Puy. That is madness when you think about it. And they're 3 years apart. But clearly there's something about that matchup that just brings out the best in the second Pliskova's first serve.
I know, exactly. But I mean, yeah, that's very niche, actually. I mean, Rebecca Marino, we saw her at the Billie Jean King Cup finals last year in Prague. We are going to be there this year. But
she better be there, Joel.
I hope so. When we saw her in person, I didn't think she had that big of a serve, if I'm being quite honest.
She definitely played first strike tennis, but I did not think the serve was kind of the standout.
I didn't think it was the standout show for her. But
I mean, I thought the forehand was just pretty handy.
I mean, maybe she's just improved it over the last over the last year or so.
She's become a bit of a favourite on the podcast now. So wherever I can get in a Rebecca Marino reference, I will.
Well, I mean, if you're going to be asking me about my highlight of the week,
I will be, Joel. Yes,
I'm going to go much broader than that, and I think it's going to be a lot of people's highlight of the week. And for me, it has to be the Napoli Cup organisation, this has just been an absolute circus, I think, throughout the week. I think it ended on a really good note. We had a great final, an all-Italian final between Massetti and Berrettini, but
on
really
a flat
getting
court in the end.
Yes, on a
not
flat
a bumpy court.
Court. And on a dry court as well, because, I mean, yeah, it was just a shambles from the off, really. I mean, well, I say from the off. I mean, even before the tournament, there were issues with the courts, the hotel room, the hotel situation. Where do I start with this? Because they had to move qualifying to somewhere like 40 minutes from the venue. This is an event that was granted a single year license, so you would think, you know, they were, you know, wanting to put on the best show possible. And, you know, to give it its dues, looking at it, it looked fantastic, you know, on the seaside, great backdrop, reminded me of like a Monte Carlo-esque backdrop, with the ocean
without
the
court surface.
But yeah, without the cops, obviously hard court. I was sort of thinking you should just never have hard courts in Italy, and, you know, maybe this was just put a hoodoo on that. It always kind of feels like it should be clay, but
indoor only.
But the court surfaces, yeah, were the biggest issue, because players got there was rain, humidity was a factor as well. Players were just kind of complaining, didn't want to play on the courts, didn't want to practice on the courts, and yeah, it looked, I mean, to be honest, at times, to me, it just looks like it was this event actually wasn't going to get finished.
I've never seen anything like it. I was looking at pictures of the court surface, and I thought, even without any expertise in laying anything in my life, I'm pretty sure I could get a flatter court than that. It was shocking. And then, as you see how this set Twitter alight, I think maybe with they having the license for 1 year, they thought, why invest? We're not getting it back. So
I know.
Let's see what will happen, and let's get some courts from Florence.
Oh, well, I mean, it was interesting because the president of the Italian Federation, Angelo Binaghi, said the ATP asked me to move the tournament from Naples. I think they asked him to move it to Florence. I said no. Now the ATP will give us a nice fine. So they're obviously not they're not bedfellows at the moment. But it was certainly very, very circus. I understand that, you know, these single year licenses, I think there is, you know, a little bit of trepidation there. And I think we've seen examples when it's been absolutely fantastic. And I think about, you know, Astana and how, you know, that has grown into, you know, a great event over the, you know, last few years.
Astrava, we've loved Astrava as well, haven't we?
Yeah, exactly. And they've really kind of grown as tournaments. But I always think you're always going to get, you know, one that actually goes the other way. And yes, I think, you know, the situation in terms of, you know, making the calendar a little bit on the fly sometimes results in these situations where these events, you know, are promised, I think, you know, very late in the day. It's like, yeah, we can put on an event within, you know, 3 months, and it feels like it could be quite rushed. So I think there's a little bit maybe of learnings for either side, you know, maybe from the Italian Federation side in terms of who they choose to lay their courts, but also from the you know, the governing body side in terms of, like, guys, we need to make sure that they've got enough, you know, in planning time to just kind of get it right, because it just didn't look like a good, it wasn't a good look all round.
I think that's true. We'll be back to a 25K, do you think, next year for that one? Yes,
well, yeah, exactly. Well, what do you think? What would you do if, you know, they've already said that they're going to be, they've already said that they're going to, like, apply and hope that they can come back next year. And I think it's good that they ended on a really positive note.
Great final. Massetti went round on his bike. I think this is a thing of legend. This is a thing of legend. Mm. Bring it back.
Yeah.
What will the court surface be like next year? It's already a PR
quintessential
story.
It's quintessentially Italian, right?
Oh, this is exactly what I was looking for in this very short Italian swing before we head to Turin. I think it's couldn't have asked for more. I was going to say one thing, Joel, on I should have said as another highlight, I did get a nod from Norrie as the sole Brit in the Stockholm crowd.
Oh, love so, that.
I did get the acknowledgement, and at the time, I think I was actually, I was cheering for him, and I don't think I actually looked myself, and the people I was with were like, you completely just blanked him, so that's kind of great to get a
Cam Norrie. Look, really with the Tennis Weekly podcast, we need to be forging
I was
friendships,
about, yes,
relationships
yes,
with yes, players, and you've just yes. blanked Cam Norrie.
Yeah, but I did cheer much louder after that as well, because I realised the error of my ways, but that has to get a special mention.
Okay. Okay, well, Cam Norrie, I apologise. If you're listening, I
also apologise.
On Chris's behalf, yes. But,
on behalf of Tennis Weekly. And Kim.
Yes, exactly. But let's talk about the matches and what has happened over the last week or so on the tour. We're going to start in Mexico, in Guadalajara, the W1000 event, the inaugural W1000 event in Guadalajara. This was where the WTA end of season finals were last season, and it was such a hit that they've come back with a W1000 event, and we have as our champion the number 3 seed Jessie Pegula defeating Maria Sakkari in the final 6-2, 6-3. Chris, what in classic Kim words, what did you make of this? Because the run that Jessie Pegula went on, it just felt like Grand Slam champion after Grand Slam champion after Grand Slam champion, and yeah, fantastic effort from her. Just even for me to get through to the final, given her position in the draw.
I mean, she very nearly didn't with the Rybakina result in the second round, having 3 match points down, and that was really touch and go. But I mean, after that, as you said, she took out Azarenka. Unfortunately, she took out Sloane Stephens, Andreescu. She's taking out all my favourites. But she did say that she saw the draw and she was a bit annoyed when she saw it. So I think it's one of those ones where she's proved kind of to herself that she could do it, and she's done it kind of in one of the toughest draws of the year. And I think when they work out, you know, the average ranking that someone plays in a tournament, this has to be almost the standout run here, because all of the players that she played, even if their ranking wasn't necessarily the highest, like Sloane or Bianca right now, I mean, the highest ranking they've been has been very high, but very impressed by her. I did not think she was a player that would play well at altitude, and by the sounds of it, the start of the week, she didn't either. She'd played a few times at altitude, and the balls, she said, seemed to fly for her, so she'd been avoiding it. So maybe that lack of sort of confidence at altitude kind of just let her hit quite freely, and she managed to come through really quite comfortably after that initial super tough match against the Wimbledon champion. What did you make of it?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, because I think, you know, reading and hearing her in interviews, she was talking about how, you know, the fact that Świątek not there, Ongjabeur not there as well, it was really an opportunity for her to kind of, you know, showcase her, you know, her talents and be like, look, I'm the de facto, you know, world number 3, and I'm here to kind of prove it. And she didn't let that, I think, you know, fluster her as she went through the, you know, the event. And I think the fact that she had such a tough route, and perhaps maybe, you know, enabled her to just kind of focus and take it kind of, you know, one match at a time. And, you know, I think about her, you know, her season. And again, we talk about consistency, and it's almost like Elise Mertens like consistency, I think she's shown, you know, this year. It's been very, very impressive. But at the same time, it's almost been quite understated. I don't think like people really... Yeah, particularly I think people who don't necessarily follow the tour kind of week in, week out, they're just, you know, they're not really that impressed by consistency. And even though it can pay dividends in terms of, you know, rankings, I think about kind of the achievements of American women, you know, of the tour this year. You know, I think Serena Williams, I think Danielle Collins, you know, at the start of the year, Coco Gauff. And I feel like they've had like bigger achievements that are more noteworthy. And I almost feel like it's put Jessie Pegula's kind of performances, her consistent performances kind of week in, week out, a little bit, you know, in the side street almost.
Yeah, I think what's really nice about it is that she's been able to, ever since the restart after the break with COVID-19, she's been able to build on what she's done. So I think there's a quote where she said that she's kind of been able to prove people wrong and prove herself wrong a little bit and keep building. And I think that's something that's so impressive and we see so often on the WTA tour, that people don't build on a success. They might have sort of a flash in the pan. They might have a great tournament. I'm not saying that there haven't been other factors for someone like Collins this year, and she has had some good results. But I think after that final, we all thought she might push on a bit more than she has. Obviously, with Rybakina, it's been a slightly similar thing in quite difficult circumstances around no points Wimbledon. And then kind of Raducanu, we so often see players not back up some of the results and start to build. So I think 2023 will be really interesting to see if she can keep building. And I think she might do some good building at the end of season championships with this sort of confidence.
Yes, I agree. I'm really intrigued to see how, you know, she gets on, you know, next season, because I think she's got a great, you know, mentality and approach. And I also think, like, again, I feel like I've banged on the drum about this every episode, but I think, again, her doubles play, she plays with Coco Gauff. You know, they've won doubles titles together this season. Again, I think her net play really, for me, is a reason that she is able to be kind of so consistent. And, you know, I think particularly in that final against Sakkari, where, you know, a very athletic player, a player I don't think you want to get into too many, you know, attritional baseline rallies, you know, from the back of the court. And I think, you know, given, you know, Pegula's kind of net play and her skills, again, she, I think, used that really, really well to just sort of keep the, you know, the shot rallies down. And really kind of put Sakkari under pressure early. And I do think, you know, she's got great weapons from the back of the court. She's just very aggressive. But I certainly think, again, having that doubles expertise just adds a little bit of a different dimension that I think kept Sakkari thinking. And ultimately, I think, you know, it was a pressure that she wasn't able to deal with.
Yeah, I think it's such a great point about Pegula, because she's able to come to the net and she's comfortable there and she's competent there. And a lot of these players, they might practice it on the training court, but when it comes to the matches, that's a very different thing. And if you're making volleys on a regular basis, on a week in, week out basis on the tour, and you've got a great sort of pace and flat sort of shots, you're able to really do some great approaches. And if you give someone a target in a final, it can go one of two ways. Either they're going to be nailing it, or if they're not, it's going to cause them sort of increased concern there. And I think that's something that we saw, that there are a lot of errors, especially in that sort of area for Pegula. But you mentioned Maria Sakkari, and I think this is the first time that I've seen her win clutch matches in such a long time. You know, that victory against Collins, 3 sets, 5-7, 6-3, 6-3, that they're playing for a place in the WTA finals. And then
it's big pressure.
The winner of Kudermentova versus Sakkari, that was for the final place. Whoever won that would qualify. And after that second set wobble, she did come through and steady the ship. So I think for her, it was a really important week, even though it was another finals loss. And obviously not winning these titles is a big blow when it comes to being kind of recognized as being one of the top players.
I think that's why when, you know, we're going to be coming to Fort Worth, you know, very soon with the, you know, the top eight. It's for me why, you know, listeners might say this is a bit harsh, but in that top bracket, it's still for me like Maria Sakkari just makes up the numbers versus is a real threat like a Jessie Pegula.
Or even a Sabalenka, when you think about it, on her day with her weapons, she can be a very difficult opponent, in the same way that I think that Maria Sakkari is not quite the same threat, because you do always know you will have those mental wobbles there. So I do agree. I think it's one of those, the people that you see in the tour finals where maybe this could be an opportunity for her because of the lack of pressure. Like she wasn't going to be there, and no one's necessarily thinking she's going to do anything particularly impressive there. So Maybe it will free her up, but I think it's still good that the last final spot was won by someone who, you know, pulled it out of the bag rather than everyone losing and then it defaulted to whoever was next in the race, you know. It did look like that might happen.
Yes, I mean, that is very, very true. And just before we move on to the, you know, the men's tournaments, the 250s, one player I want to actually just single out is a player who I just feel like just brings it for some reason only at the end of the season,
Sloane
at the
Stephens?
Very end of the tournament.
No, Sloane Stephens.
Not Sloane Stephens. Victoria Azarenka.
Ah, yes.
Defeated Badosa, top seed in the second round. Badosa did retire, you know, at the very start of the second set. But Azarenka just then, yeah, beat Madison Keys, then beat Coco Gauff, and then, yeah, lost in the semi-finals to the champion Pegula. Mm. But, yeah, just very, again, just sort of took me by surprise because she's a player who I swear we only kind of talk about. And I'm like, where's this been? Where has this been the whole of the season?
Yeah, I've seen this. It's been a bit of a run of form in this way where she won or she reached the final, the semi-finals of the last WTA 1000 of the year. So obviously she won in Cincinnati.
It's an interesting strategy.
Yeah, I think it's like bring your best game just before you stop playing for a significant period of time. Not sure how that works. But this tournament, I think, kind of makes a bit more sense to me because she doesn't have the most sort of pop on that forehand and the balls were really flying. Mm. So against someone like Madison Keys, against someone like Coco Gauff, they really did struggle to find the court at times because it was firing so quickly with the altitude. So this sort of result means I can see how this could happen in the right conditions.
But you can't necessarily see it across the whole season.
On a slower court or something that doesn't quite match up with her game as well. But she played some great tennis. I watched some of that. And you are left scratching your head thinking, why can't she do this week in, week out?
It's
why
so
do we
frustrating.
Have these... It is frustrating because she's so blooming good.
Mm. And, well, a player who is able to do it now on the men's side, I'm talking about Felix Auger-Aliassime. I mean, not long ago, he was the, laughing stock of the ATP Tour in terms of his finals record, you know, just getting to finals and always losing. And now, all of a sudden, you know, he gets to finals, back-to-back finals, and he's, back-to-back champion. Second title in as many weeks. I think he's on a 9-match win streak now. I think he won today. He beat Sebi Korda in the final in Antwerp, 6-3, 6-4. For me, he's like the danger player going into, if he makes it to the ATP end of season finals, for me, he is the danger player at the moment. He is the form player. He's great on an indoor court. I think his serving has improved fantastically over the last few months or so. I mean, I think I was reading in this tournament alone, he hit 60 aces and only 4 double faults. So it just, I think, shows you the confidence that he is playing with at the moment. And I think, you know, for me, I feel like there's a different proposition in terms of a Felix Auger-Aliassime on an indoor court versus Felix Auger-Aliassime on an outdoor court.
I mean, that is a very good point because all of his finals this year have come on indoor courts. Obviously, he's picked up 3 of them. So,
and his best victories, I think, because, you know, in the Laver Cup as well, Davis Cup.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, he's had some good wins.
He's had some really good wins. Alcaraz, Djokovic, and then picking up the 3 titles. So super impressive from a numbers perspective. I hadn't realized he was serving as well as he was. So that is something that, that will do you very well when it comes to playing against some of those big players and some of those big matches, if he can, you know, hold on to a spot and get himself there, because I think he's someone who, it's always great to see someone who's playing well at the end of the season or peaking towards the end of the season, like a form player in the end of season championships. I think, Joel, you might be agreeing with what I said on the last podcast, that I think he might be the outside favourite if he makes
it. I'm coming round to it, you know, based on, you know, what I've seen, you know, what I've seen this week. You know, he had, again, good win against Dan Evans. And then I think Richard Gasquet surprised me a little bit in the semi-finals. He gave him a really good run for his money. 36-year-old Richard Gasquet. That is, again, very, very impressive. And I'm coming around to your view on Felix Auger-Aliassime you spoke about last week. Now I've got to ask the same question of Dominic Thiem. Are you coming around to my view that Dominic Thiem has arrived, is arriving back on the ATP tour. He got to the semi-finals in Antwerp, lost to Korda in a last set tiebreak, beat Tommy Paul today in one of the matches of the season. I think he saved two match points, again, one in a final set tiebreak. He beat the top seed as well, Hubert Hurkacz. Are you as excited by Dominic Thiem as I am at the moment, or are you still kind of like, I need to see it in another tournament?
I am very pleased with his upward trajectory, I would say.
This is the most diplomatic response I think I've heard
that I've ever given on the pod, probably. But no, I think he's doing really well. I think when you look at the quarterfinal result, that could have gone either way. He's picking up wins now against players that he should be getting wins against, and that's something that's really positive. He still does have a tendency to not necessarily play fantastically well across all three sets. In the European Open, I think it was the round of 16, he dropped a 6-1 set against Cerundolo. So there's still kind of some bits to iron out. But yeah, exactly. But I think they are cobwebs, as you say. And I will say, Joel, I do agree that 2023... I think we'll see him in some major quarterfinals, maybe, I'll say.
Well, we will see. I mean, we have had some next geners do really, really well last week in Stockholm and in Naples. Holger Rune and Lorenzo Musetti both coming out as champions. You were in Stockholm for the final. Yeah, Holger Rune, very, very impressive. I thought it was going to be, you know, looking at the result, I thought it was going to be, you know, Tsitsipas losing it again. You know, my view is, you know, he has a mental block when it comes to finals. I think he's shown that, you know, this season. But I actually just think in this matchup, Holger Rune just played tennis that Stefanos Tsitsipas just could not deal with.
Yeah, I think my take, because I was there for the quarterfinals, so... I saw Tsitsipas play against Ema, the sort of home hope in that match. And I've seen Tsitsipas play before, and I really was quite shocked by how within himself he looked. He looked a little bit not positive, looked a bit dejected. I know that he has sort of the plod that he has where he just gets on with it. I think it was just really clear to me that there's a bit of a disconnect there in terms of enjoying the tennis when he's playing it. Whether he's overthinking it, I think it could be that. But it feels like he almost needs to open up the shoulders, because having seen that match, he didn't really swing and go for it. I mean, Holger played fantastic tennis.
I mean, the backhands are just night and day to me.
Yeah.
In terms of Rune and Tsitsipas.
It's completely true. And the backhand really was a big, big weakness. And under the guidance of Patrick Mortoglou, I mean, he hit every single ball he could at that backhand, and the ball came back mid-court, lots of topspin from him, lots of mishits, lots of errors. And Tsitsipas, even when he does get round the ball to his forehand, I think there's even more pressure for him to do something with it. So he's making quite a lot of uncharacteristic errors. But in that final, Rune took the ball so early and played tennis that I mean, I haven't seen someone... play like that for a little while. I think it's completely kind of lights out tennis. And he said afterwards, I think the quote was that he played very close to perfection, and it did feel like that. And it's something that's quite strange looking at it when he's 19 versus Tsitsipas, who was that sort of young hope when you think about it.
Do you think this is Rune playing 11 out of 10 and this is almost like a freak result? Or do you believe that he could reach this level consistently?
I think he's had a big turning point from an attitudinal perspective. I think there's a big wake-up call after some of the sort of contentious moments he's had about kind of with Casper Ruud, the drama that they had there, and some of the moments where he might not have had the best behavior. He is only 19, and I think a big part of what's been brought to his camp is having a really positive mindset, and he's really trying to make sure that he keeps a level head. And he said that in all of his post-match sort of press conferences when I was there about the importance of it. And I think it felt like he has a real sort of positive vibe and buzz around him now, and he's really getting that from his camp as well. So I think he had a bit of a wobble in the season after breaking through in Munich when he won that title. And kind of since then, he has now put together some results, like the Sofia final was a great result, and then winning here. So I don't think this is a flash in the pan. He looked like he was in fantastic physical shape, mental shape, and he was... getting it done. I mean, 20 yeah. aces, 20 winners, sorry, only facing one break point in the final. I think top five next year, I think.
Ooh, top five. Ooh, big call. I mean,
I honestly was more impressed by him than Alcaraz when I saw Alcaraz in Hamburg. But oh, I mean, that's...
Okay. I mean, well, you know, he did obviously get his first ever win against Cam Norrie, leaving British fans very frustrated. But I can't help but think in the final as well that Patrick Mouratoglou, he would have known a little bit about, you know, the game plan to defeat Stefanos Tsitsipas, given them having kind of previously, you know, worked together. I feel like there was also that ace in the pack.
There was a dynamic there as well that I also feel wasn't very nice, I think. You know, when we've had this before, I think we had it with Nadal and Felix when it came to sort of that sort of matchup there about where do people sit for things.
Where do people sit?
Yeah, and I mean, it was one where he was right by where the Stefanos had to pick up his towel from, and he was sort of fist pumping and cheering for the opposition. So I think that does put a sort of a bit of a different spin on things, because that's kind of quite a weird situation to be in. But I do think kind of the thing for me is with Stefanos is, why is he playing sort of so much tennis? He's playing this week again. He added Stockholm to his tournament calendar as well, and he's been playing so many matches and so many tournaments that you just think sometimes having just a bit of time off. Yeah, I think it seems like it's overkill, especially for someone who is ranked as highly as him, because it just feels like he's not able to bring sort of that mental energy to every match. And that was a lot of parallels for me between him and Tiafoe, who had a real hiccup against the younger Ima brother, coming back from love 4 in the second set. But then in his quarterfinal against Rusevori, he did not show up at all. It was almost a little bit sort of embarrassing in terms of the way that he was playing. And his answer sort of afterwards was, it's been a long year and he's pretty tired, essentially. So,
well, maybe don't play.
That's exactly what I think. Don't play the 250. Play the 500 this week. So it's a shame when that happens, because you also feel like...
feel cheated as a fan, or feel a little bit robbed as a fan when you're in the crowd.
Yeah, and the whole environment that it creates is not one of sort of the excitement when there's a lot of people are excited to watch you play.
Well, I mean, there was one event that did have a lot of excitement and a lot of passion, and it was in Italy, because organization shambles aside, we did get an all-Italian final in Naples. Lorenzo Musetti, Matteo Berrettini. Musetti, surprisingly maybe to some, winning 7-6, 6-2 on the hard court out there. Another up-and-comer, you know, Lorenzo Musetti, 20 years old. Yeah, another player with a single-handed backhand, which I find, you know, is a thing of, to me, is a little bit of a thing of beauty. Maybe he's the, you know, the heir apparent to Richard Gasquet. But I think Lorenzo Musetti is also going a little bit under the radar in terms of having putting together a very good sort of end of the season, you know, run. And, you know, against Berrettini, I always feel like you sort of know what you're going to get with Berrettini. And Musetti was just there and very able to handle it.
Yeah, he's putting together like a really good run of form. Semi-finals, pushing kind of deeper in some of the tournaments. I saw him win in Hamburg, which was very impressive again. And getting it done against top players in big moments, I think, is a really positive thing at someone at this sort of stage of their career. As we've said with Felix, it took a really long time for them to for him to get into the winner's circle. And it's clear that both kind of Holger and Musetti are players who are able to deliver on big stages and on big moments. I'm not saying that 250 is the biggest stages, but the nature of a final, and these finals were well attended and well supported and televised in their in individual countries. So the focus is on that, and the expectation that they've had is something that we've seen players be held back by it, but it seems like they're now able to embrace it much more than kind of the mid-generation who almost immediately followed the, you know, the Nadal, Djokovic and Federer sort of period, that maybe having that gap between has allowed them to have a bit more room to grow, develop and flourish. But I love watching Musetti play, and he's someone, as you say, the fluidity of that backhand is something that is very impressive to watch. And
I think, you know, just with the Davis Cup coming up, you know, they've got Berrettini, Sinner, both players, you know, have got, you know, injury doubts, injury niggles a little bit at the moment. You know, Sinner had that bad fall. Berrettini's foot this week hampered him somewhat. It was a little bit visible, I think, during the final. But again, Musetti coming into form, the Italian squad to me is very, very is quite decent. You know, you've got three very handy singles players, I think, and then you've got Fornini and Bellelli to play the doubles. Yeah, I think they've got a very, very capable squad there, providing, I think, if Berrettini and Sinner between one of them can be 100% fit.
I mean, it kind of goes without saying just how strong they are when you look at the people they're able to pull together, and they've got so many great players who are ranked pretty highly, who are all sort of there or thereabouts when it comes to the next generation. So, I mean, obviously there are players that we are more familiar with, like Sinner, Musetti, and there are players who are slightly lower ranked. But in terms of the next gen rankings, I think I saw something which said that they are the Italians are at 2 with Yannick Sinner, 3 with Musetti, and then they're at 9, 11, 12, 16, 18, 19, and 20.
They should just get another Davis Cup team. They should have like an Italy A and an Italy B team.
I think they should do, because they've got 9 of the top 20 of the next gen race are from Italy. So why not have 3 teams? Have a C team.
I'd love to see that.
Put Fognini in the D team.
Well, exactly. Exactly. Well, let's take a quick break now. But join us in the second half, where we're going to be talking about Simona Halep's suspension, provisional suspension from tennis, all the Davis Cup squads and Dan Evans' comments with regards to the GB team, and also a look at the performances so far in Vienna and Basel. So do not go anywhere.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to Tennis Weekly with Joel and Kim, sponsored by DownloadTennis.com. And now we are going to move on to, drumroll please, Par for the Courts. Par for the Courts is here. Chris, I have a Par for the Courts for you. Joel versus Chris, head-to-head, is actually on hold, whilst Kim, at the moment, I'm envisaging, is sort of stuck on a train, get back into London.
Maybe she's thinking of the next one, you know?
Maybe
she's
going to
really
toughen it up. She's sort of researching on a phone. But I do have a Par for the Courts for you and our listeners. This is going to be a traditional Par for the Courts. So I'm going to give you a topic, and I'm going to set the par score, and you're going to see if you can match it.
I'm going to challenge you already. Is it finals lost by Felix Auger-Aliassime?
That is a very, very good topic, but it's not that. It's not that one. No, but it does have to do with tournaments, not necessarily players, but tournaments. And I saw this lovely stat on social media the other day, and this is your topic, and this is the topic for our listeners as well. So the WTA and ATP respectively had 50 and 64 scheduled tournaments for this season, excluding finals and Grand Slams. Only 13 of them are combined events. And I would like you to name me as many of the combined events on the tour as possible. So events that have ATP and WTA running at the same time.
Oh, 13 is quite a lot, Joel.
So there is 13.
What are we setting par at?
I am going to set par. 12. I feel like you're always I feel like you're always very good at all the topics I set. So I'm going to say 13 out of 30. No. no, I'm going to push it here. I'm going to say 8.
Mhm. That is a challenge. Okay.
I'm going to say 8, but I'm going to give you one life.
Okay.
I may be living to regret that. I may be being a bit too nice here, but I will give you a life. So you can give me a wrong answer and you're still in the game.
Okay, can I ask one clarifying question?
Ooh, okay.
You said it's for this season.
Yes.
Okay, so it's not nothing historic. Right.
No, no.
And I'm making 8. Right, I'm feeling confident. We're going to see how we do. Okay, I'll kick off with Hamburg, which I attended.
Correct. Yes.
That one,
Hamburg
I'm
is
pretty
on the
sure
list.
I saw a women's match. Yes.
Yes.
I will go with Eastbourne.
Correct. Yes. Eastbourne also on the list. So you've got the one German answer and the one UK answer. So that's 2 so far. So 6 more for part of the course.
Rome, definitely.
Correct. Yes. Rome is on the list.
Madrid also will be on the list.
Correct. Yes, that's 4. So you're halfway there. Still got your life intact.
I'm going to go to the US now with Indian Wells.
Correct. Yes, that's 5.
I think Miami might also make a feature.
Correct. Yes, the Sunshine Double both on there. So that is 6 so far out of 13. So just reaching 50%.
Cincinnati.
Very good. Correct. Cincinnati on the list. So that's 7. So one more and you're already home and dry with your life to spare for Par for the Course.
I feel like I kind of want to use a life and go for a real curveball, but find out an answer myself if it's right. But I'm going to say Sydney because I'm pretty confident.
Yes, Chris. Sydney is correct. You have reached Par for the Course this week. Wow. I should have been a lot tougher on you. I really should have gone doubled.
I think I should have gone double digits.
Okay. What else have you got? Because there are still a few more on the list.
I definitely know Washington.
Yes, Washington also on the list.
And then then it gets a bit trickier. the only thing I can think of as a final one is that there was the Melbourne tournament before the Australian Open when players were in quarantine.
That is very good. Very good. That is a right answer. Melbourne is on the list.
And then I think I'm up because I think
there are 3 events left.
Nottingham's a challenger for the men, so that wouldn't count.
Nottingham not on there, nope.
That would have been my one if I could have used my pass. But I'm out, Joel. I'm out. I've completed it. No more.
So I will tell you all of the answers. So, as you said, Cincinnati, Washington, Hamburg, Eastbourne. Here's one you didn't get. Sir-Hertogenbosch in the Netherlands.
Did not get that.
Rome, Madrid, Miami, Indian Wells, Sydney, Melbourne, and, I mean, to be fair, this is very close to the start of the season. Adelaide 1 and Adelaide 2.
Adelaide 1. I've forgotten that Adelaide is joint.
Yeah. And they had two successive weeks of tennis, both ATP and WTA. So, a lot of combined events in Australia and, you know, potentially got the United Cup, I think it's called, coming up as well.
I don't think I'd realise how rare the joint tournaments were. You feel like, because obviously we're watching the events each week, they might be in similar places, but I guess there's, you know, Toronto and Montreal, they rotate each time. Mm. So that would be a 14th they could count as the Canadian Open, but yeah. Different locations.
You can
obviously
never have enough, I feel, combined events. I don't know
we
if
love
it's
a combined event.
I love a 500 or a 250 combined. They're just absolute for me. Great. But
chef's kiss.
Yeah, exactly. They're a little bit rogue, but I really, really enjoy those events. But
never know who you're gonna get, Joel. Well,
yes,
I'm pleased
that. Did you just say a mixed bag?
Yeah, I did.
I love it.
It is indeed. So I will be very pleased with that result, and I'm hoping that this might mean I get a week off from being put in the hot seat for next week, but I don't think it does because we're prepared for Kim. But we do have a question from the mailbag that we need to get to. And it's a particularly interesting one this week that I've actually also been thinking about. And it's from Georgina, who got in touch to ask, do you think it's right for the Wimbledon champion, Rybakina, not to be at the end of season championships? And do you think the WTA should use the same rule as the ATP? And this is a question which relates to the rule where if you're in the top 20 for the ATP race and you've won a Grand Slam, you do qualify. So that's what's happened with Djokovic this year. He won Wimbledon despite there being no points. So this is a question that speaks to, would you rather see the Grand Slam champions face off or the most consistent players across the season? So what do you think to that, Joel? And thanks for the question, Georgina.
It's really interesting, and it's weird that there is this difference. I don't know why this difference exists, and maybe it's something they look at in the future. You know, we're talking about, you know, having consistency, you know, across the board. And, you know, for me, I would like to see, you know, Rybakina in the end of season championships, because I think it's a bit, to be honest, I think her season, I know she, you know, had the high of winning Wimbledon, but I feel like she's going to become like a forgotten champion, you know, in the future, given, you know, how she's been treated. You know, she's spoken about it herself in terms of, you know, the court allocations she's been given, and just generally how, yeah, as I say, how I think she's been handled since becoming a Grand Slam champion. And the fact that she's not going to have even like almost like a full stop to her season at the end of season finals, to me, doesn't feel right if you're, you know, a Grand Slam singles champion. I remember, you know, on the ATP side, we also see it a lot, I think, in the doubles event, because that is a bit more kind of a little bit more unpredictable. You can get more wild cards and, you know, people not in the race, win a Grand Slam, for example. But yeah, for me, I think I would like to see Rybakina in there, because I think without her being there, I just think like we're just going to forget her even more. And I think she has earned her right to be there by winning a Grand Slam tournament.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think it's a big shame, and I think it's affected her season because of the fact that she hasn't felt like a Grand Slam champion. And this would have been a nice sort of...
you would have felt like a Grand Slam champion if you were able to, you know, this would have incentivized
compete
it. You know?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And she actually ends the race at 21. So she would be just outside the 20 rule. Mm. But had the points counted, she would have been number 4 in qualification above Coco Gauff. So that must be something that must be quite difficult to deal with. But it's happened sort of quite a few times on the WTA. We saw in 2021, Osaka and Raducanu, who both finished top 20. They would have got to play, and we'd love to have seen Raducanu at the end of season championships, because the nature of the game now is we do get players who win a slam and maybe don't have as good a season the next season. So it's almost like the one chance they get to show for kind of an end of season showdown between all of these players. So I think, in answer to Georgina's question, I think they should have the same rule, or there should be a rule where if you win a slam, you do get to play, because they do that for the doubles for the ATP finals.
Yeah. Yeah.
As you said, so I think it's something that happens quite more often than you think on the WTA, and I think it's a weird point of lack of, whether it lacks continuity for no reason, a very strange discrepancy, as you say.
And I'm looking at the list of players who would have qualified under the, let's call it the Djokovic rule, because as you said, Osaka and Raducanu in 2021. Sloane Stephens in 2017, you know, Lee Na 2014, Bartoli 2013, Clijsters, Sharapova. So yeah, I mean, I think for me, if I'm being really, really harsh here, like, I'd like to see a player who has a more of an unknown quantity to them in a field of eight, as opposed to kind of, as I said, making up the numbers. And I'm sorry, Maria Sakkari, but I would love to see like a Rybakina or Raducanu, yep, or someone who is going to, I think, just be a bit more of an unknown, almost as a wild card, I think. I know that sort of breaks, I think, the rules of an end of season finals. And I think, you know, there is an argument to say that you should be rewarding kind of consistency and, And, you know, it might feel disrespectful, you know, if, you know, someone can just win 7 matches in a row. But I still think that is a great achievement. And I think that, again, could be acknowledged potentially in other ways.
Yeah, I think people want to see the champion, the biggest champions of the year face off. And we, it is almost the majors are having even more significance now in terms of how players are focusing their schedules and not some players are playing less tournaments. Like, I think that's probably a case where, you know, some of these big names have protected their health and prioritized that over kind of playing all the tournaments they'd need to qualify. So I'd love to see her there. It's a big shame. And I think that it's added a good dynamic for the Djokovic side of things for this year that he hasn't missed out because of that rule.
It'll be interesting. Yeah, I mean, it will be just, I mean, last note, it will be interesting to see if any players call that out and say, you know, whether they agree with it or whether they disagree with it, because it is quite a high profile example. And, you know, a lot of, you know, Djokovic critics would probably say, you know, he's not been on the tour enough to warrant you know, being in the end of season finals. But you know, we'll have to see. But Georgina,
unless he wins in Paris, I guess.
That's very true. That is very true. I mean, Georgina, that is a great question. And listeners, if you've got any other questions for the Tennis Weekly mailbag, make sure to reach out on us on email or social media. But we're going to move on now to talking about Simona Halep, and arguably the biggest news from the week in tennis was something that happened not on the tennis court, and that was Simona Halep being provisionally suspended by the International Tennis Integrity Agency for a positive test at this year's US Open. Yeah, I mean, where do you start with this, Chris? This took me completely by surprise. Halep has had a very, very up and down, very wild season, I feel, you know, has come back from injury, working with Muratoglu, you know, has said she had a panic attack at the Roland Garros, managed to come to the Wimbledon semi-finals, lost in round one of the US Open, then has had a nose job of all things, and now and announced the end of her season before, yeah, testing positive for, I'm probably saying this wrong, but Roxdustat, which from what I understand is something to do with red blood vessels. Yes. And adding oxygen in, a little bit like EPO was my sort of analogy with cycling back in the day.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great place to start with the facts of what's happened. So she tested positive at the US Open, and the way that it works is they test your A sample, and her A sample came back positive, and then her B sample was requested to be tested, and that also came back positive. So it is two positive tests of the samples that were taken at the same time. And as you've said, yes, it is something that has been used as a performance enhancing drugs, because it is similar to EPO, as you've said. So that is something that it is able to kind of enhance your production of red blood cells. So it's something that boosts the cells, the red blood cells production there. And it kind of mimics sort of the response to kind of not having enough oxygen. So it's something that has been on the banned list for quite a long time, and it's not necessarily legally approved in all markets. So it's still not something that's legally approved in the US. So that's what the facts are. It has been shown to have benefits to helping endurance.
Do you believe it? Because I think that the question coming out of it, you know, Simona Halep's, this is what Simona Halep came out with. She said,
yes.
Today begins the hardest match of my life, a fight for the truth. I have been notified that I have tested positive for a substance in an extremely low quantity, which came as the biggest shock of my life. Throughout my whole career, the idea of cheating never even crossed my mind once, as it is totally against all the values I have been educated with. Facing such an unfair situation, I feel completely confused and betrayed. I will fight until the end to prove that I never knowingly took any prohibited substance, and I have faith that sooner or later, the truth will come out. It's not about the titles or the money. It's about honour and the love story I have developed with the game of tennis over the last 25 years. Chris, what do you make of that?
I think it's interesting in the way that it's worded, of being notified that she had the positive test in extremely low quantity. So I think it's something where it doesn't say an explanation for this. I think sometimes we've seen this before when there've been players, like I think it was Robert Farah from the men's, who it was a meat that's actually caused a problem a few times.
She's eating dodgy meat from Colombia, though, is she?
I don't think she is. And the nature of this is not that it would be that, because it's not hormone related in that way. So I think it's it doesn't tell you a lot. It tells you that she's saying that that it's not true. She's saying, but I think unfortunately, the facts are that she has tested positive for it. So the ownership isn't being taken there. So that's the only thing I was slightly disappointed for. I fully understand, you know, giving your heartfelt.
It's her integrity. For me, it's like her integrity is at stake here, because she has built up for me this image, you know, her brand and her values has very much been around, you know, an honest, you know, a fierce fighter, but also an honest competitor, and you know, a positive drugs test is gonna, you know, scream, flies in the face of that, and for me. Yeah, this statement very much is around, you know, protecting her integrity, and you know, a lot of people talking about this being, you know, the most high profile, you know, positive test since Maria Sharapova all those years ago. I mean, for me, what was quite interesting was the coach kind of statements. You know, we know that Simona has been working with Patrick Mouratoglou this season, has also worked with Darren Cahill for a lot longer, and you know, listeners, I would recommend searching out both of these statements to see what you make of them, because I don't know about you, Chris, but the one from Darren Cahill is a lot more, as understandably, you know, he's worked with her a lot longer, but it feels like he is absolutely, you know, I mean, it's pretty strong. He said, there is no chance, N-O in capitals, Simona knowingly or purposely took any substance on the ban list. None, zero. So he is putting his stake in the ground there and being really affirmative in Simona's corner. Whereas I just feel like Patrick Mouratoglou, I think he's sort of distancing himself a little bit from the situation. Mm. I mean, I know he's in Holger Rune's kind of box at the moment, but I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what he's thinking at the moment. In terms of, you know, where does this leave me? Where does this leave our coaching? Relationship. You know, I'm doing well with Holger Rune at the moment. I mean, these things have drastically changed over even just a week or so.
Yeah, I think they are slightly contrasting. I do think that it's important for both of them that they do kind of reassert her sort of integrity and the person that they know her to be. I think it is problematic at times because there is no ownership of the fact that this has happened. She has tested positive. Unless they suggest that the nature of the testing is not correct, which they haven't done, it is sort of falling a bit on deaf ears at this stage to me, because I think it's more, I want to find out what happened would be something that I'd like to hear about. And if you're a coach, that's one thing. He's not her current coach. He doesn't know exactly what she takes on what her doctor has prescribed or anything like that. So it's very much saying that if she did take something, she didn't know about it, which is fine, but it doesn't necessarily change the fact that it was in her system. I think the only thing that I would kind of draw attention to is that I remembered that she was very much sort of quite a harsh critic of the Sharapova case at the time. And I dug out those quotes because I thought it was quite interesting, because she did play her at the US Open on her comeback year from the drug ban that she had. And she said, for the kids, for the young players, it's not okay to help a player with a wild card who was banned for doping. It's not about Maria Sharapova here. It's about all the players that are found doped. I cannot support what the tournament did, but also I cannot judge. And so I think that's something that's interesting, because the nature of the Sharapova test was that she put her hands up and said it was something that I took as medicine, and I completely, through fault of my own, did not realize that year in January it was on the ban list, is what she said. So there was an ownership that was taken there, which I think is a bit of it's kind of missing from this, because it's either you suggest that the test is wrong or you start trying to find answers, because I'm not sure what you're fighting against if these two tests you're not calling into question.
This case has got, I feel like, got a long way to go. We'll have to see how it develops, but
I'd ask Joel one question. I'd ask you, was in terms of the timings of when she was told about this, apparently she was told on the 7th of October, but she ended her season on the I think the 15th of September. So I think some people have been sort of questioning if she did know something because it seemed odd when she just got the form from sort of winning in Canada to then sort of end her season. So I think that's something I was going to ask your take on. Do you think this is connected to her ending her season when she did?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, I feel, conspiracy theories at the moment.
I put you on the spot, haven't I?
Particularly in terms of, the timeline. I mean, other people talking about, is there any connection with Muratoglu? Again, don't know. Think, time, and information will help us kind of get to the bottom of this. But it's very, I mean,
it's early
just
stages,
been a very wild, it's just been a very wild season for Simona Halep. And, this is not obviously an unfortunate note to end on. And I don't think anyone necessarily wants to, some people are kind of taking sides, players, obviously coaches, and some people are remaining, quite distant from it because I just think everyone is so kind of shocked by it, given it's Simona Halep. As I say, the persona and the aura she has built up over her career that she references in her statement is such that you just have to almost take a double take when when that breaking news came through. I think for a lot of fans, so
yeah.
I think as a result, we're just going to have to take it as it comes. But I'm aware we're already over an hour allotment for our episode, and we've still got a couple things to touch on. We've got Davis Cup coming up. The squads have been announced for the final eight: Australia, Netherlands, Croatia, Spain, Italy, USA, Germany, Canada. I haven't got time to go through all the squads, but what caught my eye this week, a squad that isn't actually there but is to do with Davis Cup. Dan Evans has talked about feeling insulted at being overlooked for Davis Cup doubles. He feels like he should be asked more to play doubles. He's never played doubles for Great Britain. What very quickly, one few sentences, what do you make of that in terms of, do you think that's fair enough? Would you like to see Davis Cup Dan Evans, or do you think we're strong enough that we shouldn't have to necessarily rely on a singles player to come in and help out?
I think it's an interesting take from him at this time, because we were talking about bad doubles decisions in terms of playing a singles player in the form of Andy Murray. That was something that we thought wasn't necessarily the best thing to do on paper when you have sort of the world number one in doubles at the time, as well as kind of the form player in sort of Neil Skupski at the time. So I think there's an interesting angle there that he's actually going against the fact that he should be picked over those players. So maybe it's could be connected with Murray, if I had to sort of stipulate what this could be referring to, because that did seem like an unusual choice. But he has had some great success with Skupski in the past, and maybe he's saying it's about kind of who are the better pair. I mean, they've had a great result, I think, in Monte Carlo together. He doesn't play week in, week out, but we all know how good he is at volleying. And let's be under no illusion, if the singles players played doubles, they would be the best doubles players in the world. It's just a fact. So whether he should be picked or not is another question, whether he's a better doubles player. But I think I would go by the form book, unless the partnership isn't proved not to be working when you play those practice matches. And if it showed he plays better with Skupski, I would pick them as the pair, if I'm completely honest.
Ooh, interesting. It's so hard because Joe Salisbury de facto is the highest ranked doubles player we have.
He is, and he deserves to play, but it takes a team to win a doubles match.
Yes, I know. And it almost counts against Salisbury, I think, that he plays, with an American, he plays with Rajiv Ram. Yes, they've had great success together, but for Great Britain.
Maybe Jack Draper. Jack Draper for doubles. I love putting Jack Draper.
I mean, Jack Draper's the answer for everything, right? I mean, it's funny you talk about him, because we are going to be looking forward. Vienna and Basel on at the moment. Question, as always, what is the one thing you are looking forward to this week?
I mean, that is the number one question.
I can go first, just very quickly to get mine out of the way, because it's something that already happened, and it was Jack Draper versus Carlos Alcaraz.
Well, I was going to say that, but I thought I shouldn't. I've got one, Joel, don't worry.
Well, as I said, Jack Draper, Carlos Alcaraz yesterday in Basel, great, great match. Jack Draper, I think, has been, you know, he had a very good win against Jenson Brooksby the week before, pushed Hubert Hurkacz to a third set, pushed the world number one Carlos Alcaraz to a third set in Basel. I felt like it was an intriguing match in the sense that Alcaraz hasn't necessarily really got going since being world number one. So this was almost like a taking the pressure off, you know, pressure off things with this wing. But he was certainly made to sweat, I think, by Jack Draper. And again, just had so much excitement about his potential, and again how he's just not fazed, I think, by the situation. I still think there's, you know, I know he's very, very young, but his third set record is a little bit concerning maybe at this time, you know, but I'm really clutching at straws there. I think I'm being a bit harsh. I think this was a very good loss for him, but yeah, for me that was the, you know, that's been the thing I was looking forward to and the thing I really enjoyed watching last night.
I agree with you. I loved it. Was super impressed with Jack's physicality. And I will have a different one. I will say I am fascinated to see Medvedev versus Thiem.
Ooh.
The first time that they'd have played since, I think it must be the ATP finals of 2020, I think.
Wow.
So that will be a real test, and maybe that will answer the question as to, you know, was I
yes.
wrong to count
we'll
him
come
out?
Back to
so
it. We yeah, will come
it's all,
back
all
to
it. Play for.
Yeah, we will come back to it next week. We'll see how all the action goes in Basel, but also in Vienna as well. But listeners, I hope you enjoyed listening to this latest episode of the Tennis Weekly podcast, this latest catch up with Joel and Chris. Remember to subscribe to us on your podcasting platform of choice to stay up to date on all the action to come, including all the finals as well. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all major podcasting platforms out there. You can also listen to us on the DownloadTennis.com app. And if you like what you're hearing, then make sure to leave us a rating and comment on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
And we would love to hear from you. So follow us on social media and email the show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. It's at Tennis Weekly Pod. Email the show at tennisweeklypod@gmail.com or check out the website www.tennisweekly.co.uk.
And we will be back next time at Tennis Weekly HQ for our latest catch up, looking back on all the action at Basel and Vienna, as well as looking forward to all the action in Fort Worth, the WTA end of season finals. So I hope you can join us for that. But in the meantime, it's goodbye from Chris.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from me, and we'll see you again soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.